Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
It's so good to have you back with us again as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. In the first half hour, we're going to explore our lead story, and that's the vulnerability of our electrical grid and delivery system to terrorist attacks. And, of course, we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from somebody a lot of us never heard of, visit our fountain of useless information we have here on the set in the second half of the program, and, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. But before today's guest, we want to check in to the world news by stepping into our very busy newsroom we have here and find out late news in the world of science. Oliver Lejeune from Platts reports that colder winters could become the norm in Europe over the next 20 to 40 years. That's interesting. U.S.-based forecaster Weather Service International has said that we have recently noticed, this is a quote, recently noticed a change in weather patterns back to what we had in the 1950s and 1960s in Europe. We've had three cold winters in a row in the U.K. And the Weather Service International's chief meteorologist is Todd Crawford. He told Lejeune, quote, "We believe there's a strong likelihood that it's going to hang around for the next 20 to 30 years." Well, that's interesting. India has once again challenged the United Nations Climate Science Body, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, which we talk about a lot on this program, through a new scientific paper. U.R. Rao, that's R-A-O, he's the former chairman of the Indian Space Research Organization, says that human-induced global warming is much less than what the IPCC had said. This shouldn't be a surprise coming out of India, who incidentally doesn't want to reduce their coal use, of course. We've talked about that many times in this program, too. But they're saying the cause is reduced impact of galactic cosmic rays on formulation of low clouds over Earth in the last 150 years. That according to India. GCRs. Galactic cosmic rays, incidentally, are the ones that enter the solar system from outside, mostly from exploding stars, and help in forming low-level clouds over the Earth. The theory is that the solar magnetic field deflects GCRs, thereby impacting low-level cloud formation. While analyzing the data between 1960 and 2005, Rao says that he found that lesser GCRs were reaching the Earth due to increase in solar magnetic field and thereby leading to increase in global warming. The paper is said to be published in the Indian journal Current Science, and the CO2 is about 44% less than what the IPCC is saying it is. Laura Wood of Nanomaterials reports that nanomaterials are enabling major research breakthroughs in wind and solar energy, fuel cells, thermoelectrics, batteries, and supercapacitors, which are now beginning to translate into tangible products. Due to their unusual mechanical, electrical, and optical properties, nanomaterials are being incorporated into the new low-cost and environmentally friendly energy conversion and storage systems, says Laura. And promising greater efficiency than current technologies. And she reports the world market for these systems was $203 million in 2010, but is estimated to rise to $2,280 million by 2017. And United Press International says that supplies of natural gas could last more than 250 years if Asian and European economies follow the United States' unconventional reserves. The International Energy Agency said the abundance of shale gas and other forms of so-called unconventional gas discovered in the United States has prompted a global rush to explore for the new resource, largely led by Australia, which is quite interesting because Australia exports tons and tons and millions of tons of coal all the time, largely to China. And while that's happening, the China Daily News has said that geologists have detected a super-thick oil and gas-bearing stratus. That's a quote. In the northern part of the South China Sea, and has identified 38 offshore oil and gas-bearing basins. It says here that Wang Min, Vice Minister of Land and Resources, said thanks to the efforts of the geologists, new resources detected in the past 10 years accounted for about half of all resources found in the past half century. And the amount of new resources found each year has surpassed their annual consumption. That's interesting. Well, now on to our lead story, the vulnerability of our electricity delivery grid to terrorist attacks. We have with us back again Meyer Sassoon with the IEEE Energy Policy Committee. They advise government and industry on energy issues.
Well, one of the things that you are really, though, concerned with is the transmission lines. And the question that I hear all the time is, gee, the vulnerability of our transmission grid, our electrical grid, to, say, terrorism and shutting down a vast amounts of power to wide areas, like we've seen power outages in years past. Isn't our power grid pretty vulnerable?
Well, I'm glad you asked the question.
All right.
Because again, there's a lot of myth going into that, if you look at large scale blackouts, the most recent one was in 2003. That shut down quite a bit of the Northeast and parts of Canada. However, that had nothing to do with a terrorist attack on the grid. But it was very interesting because up to that point, in the country, except for New York, the rules to reliably to operate this interconnected grid that we have in this country, three grids that are interconnected we have in this country, the West, the East, and Texas.
Yes.
The means of operating are based on rules that have been developed by engineers over many years, but they were voluntary, except for New York. And because of that blackout, Congress in 2005 passed the Energy Act of 2005 and made the rules mandatory.
Okay.
Since then, the causes of that blackout, which was not following all of the rules as it should have been, are now part of law, and companies that violate it can get fined up to $1 million a day by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Mm-hmm.
So we now have on the one side strict rules that are getting better and stricter as time goes by. On the other hand, those rules, or part of those rules, deal with standards for security of the power grid. And those standards are getting, you know, a lot of visibility, a lot of attention. But it's one of those things that what's being happening at utilities across the country can't be talked about because it'll be a break of security to reveal what utilities are really doing to provide an much increased security of the grid. But it is happening.
Okay, now I understand then you're telling me that the grid is going to be made safe for against terrorist attacks, but you can't tell us what it is because that would be a breach of security and tip the terrorists off the way that they could defeat it. Is that what you're saying?
Themselves, Colonel, the rules themselves are available, and if anybody's interested, they go to, they can go to the National Electric Reliability Corporation, or NERC, and find them. They're called SIP rules, or which deal with security. The idea of the very large power plant that would be situated somewhere relatively far from the load and connected to the grid is giving way to the benefits of smaller power plants of all kinds that can be situated, sited closer to load, and thereby avoid having to build a lot of expensive transmission lines that no one wants to see through their backyard. And in fact, that's one of the things I'd like to make sure that the audience, your audience, do understand, because there is this statistics going around that we're falling way behind because we're not building as much transmission as we used to, and we're building many more power plants than transmission, so therefore something really bad is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But when you peel the onion a little bit and look into it, what's happening is that there's a lot of resources that are smaller, that are being siting very close to load, that do not need the transmission system as much, and are very efficient. And I think small nuclear power, which is your question, has a place in that equation too.
All right. If we're gonna talk about nuclear power, then we also have to talk about nuclear waste. What's the solution to nuclear waste?
Well, that is a very difficult question, right? It's a societal question. But one of the things that we need to do a better job at is reprocessing spent fuel, so that we can use the fuel that is in our power plants to a much higher degree than we normally do, and therefore cut down considerably nuclear waste. But as a society, we need to come to grips with that, and it's not a technical issue, it's more of a societal political issue of how we store and where do we store. So it's not something IEEE USA gets involved with, because it's really not a technical issue that we need to understand or develop the technology to do this.
All right. Well, Meyer, this is the second year now of chairman of the IEEE USA Energy Policy Committee. What are your goals for this year? What do you want to accomplish?
Well, the first thing we did as a committee was update these National Energy Policy Recommendations,
okay,
which can be found at the IEEE USA website. And those recommendations have four pillars. One is increasing energy efficiency. Another one is the greening of the power supply. Another one is reducing our dependence on oil,
mm-hmm,
by transforming transportation. And finally, the fourth pillar is building a stronger and smarter electrical energy infrastructure. Now, take those four pillars, and we decided that these are so important that we're going to be issuing documents on each one of them. We call them position statements.
Mm-hmm.
And we already have two of them out. So about a year ago, we were one of the first things under my chairmanship was the one on building a stronger and smarter electrical energy infrastructure. The board of the IEEE USA just approved one a couple of months ago on increasing energy efficiency.
Okay.
We're hard at work right now on the one of reducing our dependence on oil by transforming transportation. We expect to issue that sometime this year.
All right.
And then hopefully by the end of the year, attack the final one, which is the greening of the electric power supply. So that's my goal. During the 2 years of my chairmanship, and that's going to be only 2 years, according to the convention, I would like to get these recommendations with all of the depth that are needed so they're well understood. These recommendations are so important that at the annual meeting that's coming up in March, beginning of March, of the IEEE USA, the board decided to award this energy policy recommendations, and me as a chair then, a citation of honor, which is really not only me, I get the award, but it's the committee that did all the work, or most of the work anyways, but it is something that makes you feel very good that this work that about 45 people under my committee and the Energy Policy Committee is working on is really doing something that is considered important, and hopefully some of this will get into governmental policies and so that we can get to the goals that we would like to get to.
All right. Meyer Sasson, Con Edison and chairman of the IEEE USA Energy Policy Committee. We're so grateful that you took your time to be with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Colonel. Thank you for the opportunity of talking about this very, very important subject.
Right now, all the way from England, we have on the phone with us Annie Hersine. She's the director and team leader for an EP NanoNet Summit going on in Houston, Texas. Are we talking to you from London, Annie?
That's exactly right, Colonel, yes, in London.
Wonderful. It's so good to have you with us. Tell us a little bit, what is the EP NanoNet Summit?
So EP NanoNet is an organization that's been running since 2008.
Mm-hmm.
We have brought a number of oil companies and university researchers, nanotechnology researchers as well, together for the purpose of looking at the potential for nanotechnology applications in the oil and gas industry.
Okay.
Obviously, it's been very focused in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
What we're now trying to do is we're holding our first summit. That'll be on the 17th, 18th of February in Houston, and inviting a global audience, so representatives from oil companies, from the research institutes, from nanotechnology organizations, to come and participate in the summit, where we'll be talking about a variety of topics.
Can you give us an indication of what is going to actually go on there? You're going to have a lot of oil companies there, and of course, Houston's a good place to do it because it's the headquarters for so many of the oil companies. And how is nanotechnology going to be applied to oil? Is it with extraction, or is it going to be with refining, or in what sense?
So there are a vast number of applications that could be used within the oil and gas industry. We've already seen some being deployed already, but the whole purpose of EP NanoNet is to try and expand that potential, to really engage with the nanotechnology community and help them bring the technology into the oil and gas environment. So as I say, we have representatives from oil and gas companies that are interested in bringing it in, who are very keen to hear from nanotechnology companies. For this particular summit, which is our first one within EP NanoNet, we have a title called looking at nano-enhanced materials for construction in oil and gas. So we have taken a fairly narrow scope that we'll be looking at, but we'll be focusing in detail at some of the potential solutions that might be out there, already available, potentially being used in other industries, and how we might transfer those into the oil and gas industry.
Now, you're talking about rebuilding the molecules of gasoline, let's say, and oil with using nanotechnology and making them more efficient. Is that the idea?
Our focus for this summit in particular is really on the construction phase within oil and gas. So in particular, we'll be looking at some of the limitations that exist at the moment and how nanotechnology might have enhanced elastomer development, polymers. We might also look at surface coatings, and then other materials that can really improve the strength of materials whilst maintaining a sort of lightweight efficiency, so that we can get these materials down into the well to be able to drill, to construct the well in the first place.
All right, and there's a feeling then that this is going to make extraction from the well better, and also materials that are manufactured using petroleum, making them better too, better polymers and that sort of thing. Is that what we're talking about?
So it's looking at the materials that are used to create the oil well or the gas well,
okay,
and trying to reduce the costs that are associated with creating a well in the first place, so that we can actually access the oil and the gas in the ground, in the reservoir, a lot more cheaply, and get that oil and gas out of the ground.
What are some of the companies that are going to be participating in the summit, Annie? Can you give us an indication?
So some of the companies will include the large international oil companies such as Shell, BP, Chevron. We were also inviting a number of the national oil companies, so we hope we might see the likes of Petrobras from Brazil, Statoil from Norway, and a number of companies as far away maybe as in Malaysia or the Far East as far as that. We've had significant interest from around the globe.
And what are it's all oil companies, but there's nanotechnology companies going to be represented there also. Is that correct?
That's exactly it. So we'll obviously have the oil companies. We're also expecting to see a lot of the service companies and the larger vendors within the oil and gas arena already, many of them being based in Houston, obviously. But then also we're inviting leading nanotechnology researchers, so whether that be within universities or within research organizations, whether it be from Europe, from the Far East, or within the States, so that we can really hear about what is the state of the art in nanotechnology, and how can we take that into an oil well environment where you may well see that temperatures are a lot higher, the pressures are a lot higher, and we're working maybe with some toxic chemicals as well. So how does the application of the nanotechnology that these researchers are working on at the moment, how can we transfer that into that much more extreme oil and gas environment?
Of course, modern-day nanotechnology was pioneered at Rice University, where the discovery of the buckyball there in Houston. Is Rice part of this event at all?
Exactly. Yes, they've been with us right from the start. We're working with Wade Adams, and we've been very engaged with them, and we're very aware of the research that they're doing within the university. But I think what we're trying to do now is try to take much more of a global perspective as well, acknowledging Rice's position, but then also looking at what other universities are doing and other research bodies.
Yes, you have a countryman who won a Nobel Prize with research that he did with the team that discovered the buckyball. Harry Croteau is a good friend of mine, and I speak with him every once in a while. Do you know Harry?
Fantastic, yes. I mean, we know his team, and we've been watching the advancements that they've been making, which is very, very exciting and offers huge potential in a number of environments, and probably not only just the oil and gas industry.
Now, this is your first summit in Houston, but you've been doing this, you say, since 2008. Have you had them in the UK or someplace on the continent?
This will be our very first summit in the format that we've explained, and in a sort of open conference. Mm-hmm. Over the first 18 months, we held more focused member workshops where we were looking at trying to develop a roadmap to establish the route for nanotechnology into the oil and gas industry.
Well, Annie, right now we have to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to want you to bring us up to date on if this nanotechnology applications that you're talking about and going to be studying at the summit in Houston will be used to make us more safe from oil spills like we had in the Gulf of Mexico. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. Who in the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Oh, British Prime Minister Harold Wilson. An intellectual, that's a person who is educated beyond his intelligence.